Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour. Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Happy New Year, Toby.
Thank you, Suzanne. Right. And to you.
Thank you very much. Good to have you on board. We know what it means when it's the new year. There are new model cars on the market. If you've thought about buying a new car in 2020, what should you look for? And let's have a little look at last year too. What are some of the more newsworthy motoring moments? So, Toby, what will 2019 be remembered for when it comes to motoring?
Well, a pretty tough year for the market, Suzanne, and not just in Australia. I mean, yes, Australia's had it tough, but the industry generally has been hit very hard around the world, but certainly in Australia, yeah, down out 8.2% for the first 11 months of the year. I've been trying to calculate it back. It's actually the first year in more than a decade that every single month has seen a drop in sales. So I think we're up to 19 or 20 months now of continuous sales drops. Everyone's feeling the pinch.
Are the reasons for that clear?
Look, it's there are multiple reasons. One of the major ones is consumer confidence. The car market often tracks consumer confidence pretty closely. Once people aren't feeling too good about their finances and their businesses start clamming up with their money, then all of a sudden it can affect the car market pretty significantly. Look, obviously the drought probably doesn't help, and also house prices. I mean, obviously we're seeing house prices starting to bounce back now in some parts of the country, but a lot of people use their houses to finance a car, particularly a luxury car. So once those house prices start coming off, people aren't as confident about borrowing against it to spend up big on a car.
Right. Well, they're starting to edge up again. I guess if the car sales start going up, we'll see that there's a very direct correlation.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's multifaceted. And look, the other thing is, in some areas of the market, prices have been going up, particularly in the smaller cars. So all of that has an impact for sure.
Mm. All right. So why were the small car prices going up?
Look, one of the major factors there is the amount of safety gear that's going on them. So you look at things like Mazda 3 and Toyota Corolla. Each of those ones, in their new generation models, which have arrived over the last 18 months or so, each of those cars has gone up sort of $2,000 or $3,000 for the base model vehicle. And that's as a result of putting in things like auto braking systems. So they've got a pretty expensive radar that has to look out the front and look for vehicles up ahead. Things like blind spot warning and so on. So once you're putting those active safety features in the car, it's pretty easy to mask them in a $50,000 or $100,000 car, another grand or two in the production cost, not too difficult to mask, but a lot trickier in a car that starts at $20,000-odd. So you're really starting to see those prices go up. Look, currency fluctuations to some extent as well, particularly a lot of our cars come out of Japan. And the exchange rate's come back a little bit in the last few months, but it's certainly been pretty tough for that exchange rate. So a bunch of factors there affecting that as well.
Mm. Now, 2019, you reckon, was the year of hybrids.
Yeah, big time. I mean, look, hybrid cars have been in Australia for 20-odd years now. And we started to see, probably about a decade ago, a bit of a pickup with things like the Toyota Camry Hybrid. So it was the first of the, well, actually the only locally made hybrid ever in Australia. And it was picked up pretty heavily by fleets and governments and started to sell pretty well. But it was still a relatively small percentage of the market. But this year, or last year, I should say, we've really seen a pickup in hybrid vehicles that are getting bought increasingly by families. So probably one of the bigger ones is the Toyota RAV4 Hybrid. So it's had waiting lists of up to 6 months on some models. So people prepared to wait to get that fuel saving that it promises. Look, the interesting thing with the hybrids that are selling well, so Corolla and RAV4, as I said, two of the bigger ones, is that it's not a particularly high-tech hybrid system in these cars. It's actually the battery technology in there is quite old. But what they've been able to do is make them very affordable. So in the Corolla, for example, it's only a $1,500 premium to get into the hybrid. So a lot of people are saying, well, hey, that suddenly ticks the box for me. Because they can pay off those fuel savings within about 2 years. So it starts to make a lot more sense. And really, you know, we all talk about electric cars and when are they going to take off. The biggest thing here with all these new technologies is price. The minute they start to become price competitive, all of a sudden they start to pick up. And it's not that different, I think, with other things. Solar systems on your house. I mean, when, you know, if people say the solar system, if I can pay that off in 2, 3, 4 years, all of a sudden that starts to make a lot more sense. If it's a 30 or 40 year payoff, I don't think many people will bother with it. So
where are we at with electric vehicles? I mean, there's been so much talk about them.
Oh, there has. And look, there's been talk, well, probably for around a decade now, but in the last few years, you're starting to see all of the mainstream makers working towards it. And we started to see more of them roll out in 2019. So look, the biggest one, I guess, was Tesla with the Model 3. The interesting thing with the Model 3, it is the first electric car on the market that is pretty much price compatible with an equivalent petrol engine, so a petrol engine vehicle. So starts around $65,000, $70,000, competing with things like BMW 3 Series, Mercedes-Benz C-Class. So that car has taken off. Unfortunately, Tesla doesn't report its sales figures at a country level. They report them for globally for their manufacturing and so on, but they don't report individual sales figures. But the amount of them you're seeing around anecdotally suggests there's quite a few out there. And the other thing is, there's been some stories, people starting to delve into other data sources and suggesting that there are at least a few thousand of them on the road already. So that's suggesting a pretty big number. And look, we saw Mercedes come out and launch its first electric car in 2019. And in 2020, we're going to see a lot more. Audi, Porsche, Volkswagen and a bunch more are going to have them on the market this year.
Now, you reckon it was the year that the ute market changed?
Yeah, it changed a fair bit, I think. And we've seen enormous change in the ute market. I mean, if you go back 15 or 20 years, it was dominated to a large extent by the locally made Ford Falcon and Holden Commodore. Those started to peter off a decade or so ago, and we started to see the dual cab utes, the high riding ones, the four wheel drives, they really started to come into favour, and they have been absolutely booming. And then in recent years, we've seen the top end of the market just take off, and that really cemented itself in 2019. So to the point where you've got things like a Ram, what used to be called the Dodge Ram, now just the Ram, and Chevrolet Silverado. Both of those cars are now sold in Australia, and they're actually imported into Australia with the steering wheel on the left-hand side. They undergo a major conversion to right-hand drive in Australia, all done down in Melbourne, and hit the market. Some of them, or most of them on the market, at over $100,000. So you've got these enormously expensive utes out there. But they've been selling pretty well. I mean, they've been going amazingly well. One that hasn't gone so well, Mercedes-Benz with the X-Class. And I think they've probably learnt the hard way that you can't really take shortcuts with this car. The rumours are that it's going to be killed off pretty soon over the next, probably the next year or two. It's not going to go to an updated model, is what all the reports are saying. And it has just not sold in anything like the numbers they would have liked. So it's certainly been a tough sell there for Merck with what is a very expensive ute that at the end of the day has a lot of Nissan hardware underneath and comes out of a Nissan factory. And unfortunately, it looks like a lot of people saw through that.
Toby Hagen is with us. Before we start taking your calls, we're just running through some of the, the notable points about motoring in 2019 before we leave 2019 behind us and move into 2020. Chinese cars increased a lot in popularity. We're buying more.
They did, yeah. So actually 70% growth in cars sourced from China. But we probably should keep that in perspective a little bit. So they still only make up 1.7% of the market. So it's still a tiny percentage of the market. But look, one of the big movers there was MG. And a lot of people obviously think MG, British brand. And that's right, it is a British brand. But these days it's owned by a Chinese company and all the cars come out of China. So that one sold over 7,000 cars in 2019. They now outsell Mini, Jeep, Skoda, Peugeot, Volvo and a bunch of others. And they're closing in on other brands like Lexus and Renault. So selling very much on price, which is, I guess, the formula for new or upcoming brands that are trying to muscle into what is an extremely competitive market. But those cars are certainly picking up. But as I said, I mean, you look at the overall percentage of Chinese vehicles, only 1.7%. Compare that with some of the other countries. Japan makes up 31% of the cars sold here. Thailand, 26%. Korea 14%. So they're the top three countries that we source cars from in Australia.
And finally, it was the year that Australian cars disappeared.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, look, obviously local manufacturing ended late in 2017, but we still had cars flowing into the market, particularly in the first half of 2018. So there were sort of 4,000 or 5,000 Australian-made cars sold in 2018. In 2019, fewer than 50 Australian-made cars were sold. So, and I looked at the November sales figures. I think the only one sold was a single Holden, so it would have been a Commodore. That market is obviously drying up. So a bit of a sad day.
So are there still some sitting around in the dealership somewhere?
Look, I dare say there will be some. And what you might find, and this is what happened when Holden was building the Monaro in the early 2000s. And they finished it, I'm trying to think, 2007 or 2008, somewhere around there. And one dealer held on to a single car for about, it was about 7 or 8 years he held on to that Monaro, and then he sold it and said, okay, this is the final one. Off it went and got sold. So I dare say there'll be a dealer or two that do that, that hold on to a single car here and there. And look, if you absolutely wanted one, I'm sure there'll be someone sitting around somewhere. But for the most part, no, they're all gone and, not many around. Mm.
Toby, why don't we hit the phones? Because there's plenty of people wanting to talk to you. I'm just going to start with an SMS that was the absolute first question that came in tonight. Gareth from Queanbeyan says, hi, Toby, I want to trade in my 2018 Toyota Corolla Ascent Sport for a new drop tray ute auto petrol under 30,000. What do you recommend?
Wow, that's the end of the ute market that isn't really booming these days. I mean, certainly the top end, as we touched on before, the top end of the ute market's where all the action is these days.
So if he wants to spend $100,000, he's good.
He's got no problem with $60,000-$70,000 utes, not an issue. But look, I guess at that end of the market, there's probably two options that you'd really want to look at. One is the Hilux, and that is a fairly strong in that bottom end of the market. They do the Workmate versions, which have sort of got the very basic interiors. But these days, they've got a fair bit of safety stuff in them too. And also the Mitsubishi Triton. So, look, if I was choosing between the two, I'd edge towards the Hilux. But, Triton certainly has exceptional value, and they tend to throw a fair bit at it. The one thing I would say, though, I'm stepping out of a Corolla into a base model drop tray ute. It's very much a work vehicle. It's going to be going backwards in terms of the way it drives. All those utes are pretty agricultural vehicles. So hopefully he's got a job to do with it, something to throw in the back of it, because otherwise you're wasting your time with one of those. So, I'd as I said, tend towards the Hilux.
All right. Thanks for your question, Gareth. Ian has given us a call. G'day, Ian.
G'day, yeah, there. Toby, could you just give me a bit of advice? I've got an old Ford Ranger. It's got 365,000 on the clock, and I do a lot of towing, and I want to trade it in or sell it, and I don't know whether to go for the 3.2 single turbo diesel engine that the Ranger do, or the 2-litre bi-turbo one. What do you reckon?
So you're obviously doing a fair few kilometres. Yeah, what year model is your current car?
It's about 6.5 years old.
Yeah, right. So what are we looking at there? 40,000 k's a year, something like that.
Yeah.
More, 50. Wow, that's big k's. Look, with those sorts of kilometres, I would definitely steer you towards the 2-litre twin turbo engine. You'll notice it's a fair bit quieter than the 3.2. So when you're sitting there doing freeway driving and so on, you won't have that sort of gurgling sound that the 3.2 can make. It's also got a little bit more torque, so it's going to help you out in terms of the towing, I guess, that low down grunt, that pulling power that you need. And the 10-speed automatic is also a slicker unit and gets the engine in its torque band at a better, or more often. So you're more likely to be using that big torque that it does have. So obviously it's a step up in terms of price to get the 2-litre engine, but I think you'll actually probably, with the kilometres you're doing, I would imagine you'll probably pay that back in fuel savings, and certainly you'll end up with a nicer machine as well.
Right, yes, I've tried them both. I just wondered about, the old dictum about size does matter.
Durability. What sort of weight are you towing?
Horse floats and a fairly big caravan we've just bought,
Yeah, right. So what, 2 or 3 tonne or something, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I sort of, any time I think with those utes that you're getting over 3 tonnes, I would start to look elsewhere at things like Toyota Land Cruisers and so on that have got a bigger, you've obviously got a V8 engine with that and it'll do a better job, because you are working things like fuel injectors and so on pretty hard on those utes. But that would go across the range. I'd say that with the 3.2 or the 2-litre. I wouldn't have as much of an issue with the 2-litre in terms of the ability of the engine to do it and to do fairly big kilometres, I think should be fine. Obviously, I guess they've only been on the market, 18 months or so now, that engine, so it's still got a bit to be proven, but certainly haven't heard of things going bang at this stage. The other thing to keep in mind with all those utes, and I'm sure you've probably taken this into account previously, is what it can do to your gross combination mass and your gross vehicle mass in terms of the loading of it. So, because with some of them, once you're getting up over 3 tonnes, you can't actually put much in the ute itself. You might be limited to, say, 2 people and some basic luggage. So keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, the caravan is under, by the whole vehicle load, I think it's about 400 or 500 kilos. Underneath the maximum limit. So, I don't think I'd go into a Land Cruiser. It's going to be too expensive.
Yeah.
But so the caravan fits into that. So you reckon that the 2 litres would be all right for towing that?
I would think so, yeah. I mean, they're certainly, it's a pretty strong engine, and I think it'll do a reasonable job, yeah.
All right, Ian, thanks very much for your call. Vince has given us a ring. G'day, Vince. You want to have a yarn about Mazda?
Hi, I wanted to check with you the upside and the downside of CX-3 turbo diesel.
How many kilometres roughly do you do in a year?
About 20.
20, okay. So in those small SUVs, like a CX-3, I would only, well, actually, in most situations, I wouldn't be bothering with the turbo diesel, to be honest, because I think the market is absolutely shifting towards petrol engines, both with passenger vehicles and with the smaller and mid-sized SUVs, partly because the engines themselves are so much better. And on top of that, diesels, some of the modern, pretty much all of the modern diesels these days have these particulate filters, which self-cleaning filters that can clog up. And if they do, they can also be pretty expensive. And the only way to clear them is to go and drive them for 20 minutes, half an hour to try and get the enough temperature into the exhaust to get the basically help them burn off. So with all that fussing around and the additional cost up front of the diesel engines, I wouldn't be bothering too much with the diesel. And you're not going to get nearly as much of a fuel saving out of the diesel at that end of the market, particularly when you're doing 20,000 k's a year. Very different story when you're talking about a sort of 2.5 ton plus SUV or a ute, where you're lugging around a fair bit, and the fuel savings could be a lot more. But at that end of the market, I'd definitely be sticking with the petrol engine.
All right, Vince.
What's the downside?
What's that? Sorry.
The downside to the car.
Oh, the car generally? Downside, well, look, it's effectively space-wise the same as a Mazda 2, so it hasn't got, it's got quite a small boot, and in the back seat it's fairly cramped. But the car itself, it is one of the stronger of those smaller SUVs. Some other ones I'd get you to consider, the new Kia Seltos, which hasn't been on the market too long, but it's been out for probably 3 or 4 months now. It is a surprisingly good car, and also the Toyota CHR. So those two are also worth a look in that end of the market.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Vince. Now, we're just mentioning the Mazda 2 there, and you reckon that's probably one of the better examples of those cheaper cars that are getting more expensive because of the new safety systems.
Yeah, massively more expensive. I mean, you look at, Mazda has just done an update on that Mazda 2, and it was previously priced at $15,570 plus on road costs. The new model has gone up to $20,990 plus on road costs. So it's a 35% price hike with that car. And really, that does show you how much more those extra safety features are costing. And that one does have the full suite of active safety features. So it's got the auto braking in forward and reverse. It's got blind spot monitoring, a bunch of other stuff. But what it does, it instantly cuts out a lot of those people who just say, and that market is so price sensitive. So the people who say, I can't find another $1,000 or $2,000, all of a sudden, they're wiped out of that market with that car. They'll go and look at something else, whether it's a Kia or a Hyundai or something else in that segment. So look, it's certainly costing a fair bit more with those cars. And what I tend to think, I think the market they're probably going for there is more, rather than the younger people who do tend to scratch around for the grand or two extra, they may be going for the retirees or the empty nesters who have decided to downsize. They still want the creature comforts, I guess, but they don't necessarily need the size. So that's I tend to think the market they're heading for a bit more with that car.
So is there still plenty on offer for those people who can't spend more than about 15 grand, those people looking maybe for their first car, new car?
I wouldn't say plenty, but there are cars out there, absolutely. So you can get into that smaller end of the market. But it's not as bulging as it was. I mean, you go back 5 or 6 years and there was plenty of action there. And most of the car makers say that they pretty much can't make a buck out of those cars. It's all about just getting people used to the brand, introducing them to the brand, and hopefully stepping them up
to more
expensive models. Yeah. So stepping them through to other models. And look, some of them have walked away from that market. I mean, Subaru has never really been in it. And you know, a lot of brands these days are saying it's getting too tricky. So they tend to steer out. But look, Suzuki Swift gets sort of close to that price. I think at the moment a Toyota Yaris does, but they're about to do an upgrade on that, and I suspect that will also jump up in price quite a bit as well, because they're going to be going down the safety system route. And to put all that in perspective, people might be wondering and saying, well, hey, I don't necessarily need all this active safety gear. It's all necessary to meet the latest ANCAP, or Australasian New Car Assessment Program, safety ratings, to hit the 5-star ratings, you have to have the auto emergency braking and a bunch of other active safety features to be able to get 5 stars. So that's why some of them are pushing pretty hard to try and get that market. So, yeah.
I know. Look, while we're talking about young people entering the market, Matt would like to sort of have a yarn about this idea. Hi, Matt.
Oh, g'day. Look, I've just heard anecdotally, curious about the young person segment. I wonder how attractive new cars are these days with the price of second-hand cars, but specifically people aren't necessarily as interested in getting their licences because of Uber and public transport and the cost and all the debt and things like that. And I just wonder where the young person segment, the first segment, is really affecting new car sales at the moment.
Yeah, look, yeah, I think you'd be absolutely right. I don't think it's what I think is happening more with younger people at the moment. And look, let's face it, a lot of them don't necessarily dive into a new car. They'll go into a secondhand car. But that can still have flow-on effects to the new car market as well, because suddenly it depresses. If you haven't got as much demand in the used car market, it depresses prices a bit, and all of a sudden people might say, well, hang on, I don't want to sell my car for that. I'll hold on to it for another year or two, which flows all the way back up to new car sales. So yeah, I think you're right, and certainly, I guess the price for a lot of younger drivers has also effectively gone up because of these manual or auto-only licences. So they've got to end up paying another grand or two for the automatic transmission. Younger buyers generally. I mean, it's a concern for the industry, the automotive industry around the world, and they're trying to work out how to make vehicles more appealing to younger buyers. And what tends to be happening with these, with a lot of younger people, as you say, it's being able to get rideshare service, it's being able to more easily get public transport, lean on your parents, whatever it is to get around. But they also, they tend to be, obviously they don't have a lot of money to throw around, and they tend to look at what they can afford. And for a lot of them, they'd prefer to get a smartphone or the latest gadget and stay up with their friends in that regard rather than buy an old bomb of a car. So it's certainly a changing market. But as I said, huge concern for the industry. And they're working very hard to try and work out ways to make their vehicles more appealing and to, if not, to adjust to a smaller market moving forward.
All right. Thanks very much, Matt. Well, I know they want to appeal more. They're going to be putting the prices up. They're going to find themselves stuck in a bit of a wedge there, aren't they?
But if you look at it, I mean, look at the smartphones that they tend to go for, and they're not. I mean, you can buy a phone for $50 or $100 if you want, but they don't aspire to own one of them. They will happily go out and spend $500 or $1,000 on a phone. So at that end of the market, they in some ways they're prepared to pay a premium for some products. So I think the car industry might be looking at that as well.
Mm. Toby Hagen is here. It's Motor Talk. We're taking your calls and running through some of the latest motoring news. One from the SMS, Jennifer says, I'm looking for a towing vehicle. I'll be towing around 2.5 tonnes. Am I better with an auto or manual? Any suggestions? Four-wheel drive, second-hand, around 20K.
Wow, I was thinking of all these options before you got to the bit about $20,000, which is where it suddenly gets tricky, because with something like a tow vehicle, you're looking at, well, reliability tends to be fairly important. And once you're talking at 20 grand for an SUV, and let's face it, 2.5 tonnes, you need a bit of weight there to actually meet the regulations and be able to tow the car, tow whatever it is you're towing in the first place. So it does start to get a little bit tricky. But look, what end of the market would I be looking at? I'd be looking at things like a Mitsubishi Pajero Sport or a Challenger, which was the Challenger was the one before it. So you'll certainly get some of those around that sort of money. They're not particularly great things to drive on their own, but they will do the towing side of the equation reasonably well. I don't think you can have any luck with things like a Toyota Prado. You'll have to go pretty old for one of those to get close to it. And the other thing is a bunch of the dual cab utes. So you can start to look at, well, another one, Mitsubishi Triton. You can look at things like a Mazda BT50 would be pretty nice going at that end of the market as well. But yeah, I mean, I'd be looking at condition as much as anything with those vehicles to make sure that they are up to the task and they don't have massive kilometres on them, because you're going to be working the engines pretty hard to lug around 2.5 tonnes.
Thanks for your SMS, Jennifer. Hello, Reggie.
Reggie. That's me. Sorry.
Yeah, that is you. You're up.
Just a couple of things. First of all, to all the people in the ABC, Tom, who else you got? Old mate, you know, Bazza, and me and Isa, Duchess. All these people, I want to say hi to them all.
All right. Hello. Thanks, Reggie.
Also, electric cars. Toby, do you think this is just sort of a bit hypothetical? I know you obviously understand that we could probably get our houses independent of the grid and self-sustainable. I mean, from what I've been looking around for about prices now using a Tesla battery, which I believe is the best we got at the moment, but there's people in California working on a different style of battery that apparently is better than lithium ions. Mm-hmm. About, say, 15,000 now, you could do it in an average house.
Yep.
And it all comes down through an inverter. So we take low voltage power and turn it into high voltage power because that's sort of easy. We don't have to change our utilities, washing machines, all that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, electric cars. Basically, in my crazy thoughts, you could make a chassis. Okay, electric cars. We got this thing, the wheel. It's pretty similar. Well, electric motor fits in a wheel pretty good and it powers it pretty good just for a pretty decent amount of time and a good speed.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe in electric bicycles, get on YouTube and have a look at some of the crazy stuff they're doing with electric bicycles if you don't believe in.
Rich, is there a specific question for Toby?
Do you think you could make an electric vehicle, say, it runs back wheel all the time, back up is its front wheels? Customizable, like, so you've got a basic chassis, but you can fit whatever you want on top of that chassis. Batman car if you want, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so you mean like a manufacturer doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I think subscription is a good way to go, and I think our governments have to give us an alternative.
Yeah.
State governments have to give us an alternative.
So if you look at the BMW i3, and that's effectively the premise they came up with that car. So it was actually pretty much all passenger cars these days are monocoque, so the body is sort of built into the structure of the car, whereas your utes and your big four-wheel drives are separate chassis, so they've got the chassis underneath and the body bolts on top. The BMW i3 electric car, it actually has that separate chassis system underneath it, and the whole idea was to be able to plonk different bodies on the top of it. They've never got around to that because the sales of it haven't been terrific and the price of it is fairly out there at the moment. So the challenge with electric cars, which you've sort of touched on, is the price of the batteries. That is the expensive part of them. And any time in the past that a manufacturer has looked at doing interchangeable body panels and being able to change the top or certain panels of your vehicle, no one's really taken it. They've never really taken off. Smart did it years ago, the little smart cars, and no one really got into it. So I guess the platform of the car would be the starting point, and then they could put different bodies on top at the factory and people choose the ones they want. But that's sort of where, as I said, BMW's been looking at. A lot of them are heading down that path. Volkswagen's got a bunch of cars coming out under the upcoming ID brand, and they'll be using that effective manufacturing technique as well. So that sort of thing is in play. But the challenge with it all is the price of those batteries. So I think, until the battery prices come down a fair bit, then we're still a fair way off them being big sellers in terms of impacting the overall market, similar to what hybrid vehicles are today. But we're heading down that path at some point over the next 10 or 15 years.
All right. Thanks, Reggie. Now, look, while we're talking about electric cars, Toby, we should just note the Mercedes-Benz has produced the first electric car. I think we've touched on that. Also, it's an SUV.
Yeah, that's right. EQC. So EQ is the sub-brand that Mercedes is attaching to all its electric and hybrid vehicles. So not exactly cheap. This car's, it's on-road, starting at about $145,000. Interestingly, you go to their website and it actually says that they can't deliver them until October this year. So they're saying there's a 10-month waiting list on those cars already. Now, with all these electric vehicles, they're pretty low low volume, so they're not going to be selling them in massive numbers. But I guess it's showing that there's certainly some interest there at that end of the market to start off with. So yeah, it's certainly a terrific car to drive. They've done a nice job with it. I think the best riding in terms of the most comfortable suspension on a Mercedes-Benz in more than 10 years. It's I think they've gone backwards with a lot of their suspension systems with some of their cars, and that one is a bit of a return to form.
All right, and then what's going on with the Tesla Model 3?
Tesla Model 3, well, they've been selling them in pretty good numbers so far. But one of the things with Tesla generally is they're one of a number of the brands that are actually ditching AM radios on their cars.
So no, well, no one's allowed to buy one then.
Yeah, that's right. So
unless they've got full internet access,
and this is something that a number of electric cars are doing. So they're so some of them are saying that it's too hard to shield the electric or the aerials in the AM radios. So you get that humming, you know, if you drive drive under a high voltage power line, you get the humming. Yeah. Yeah, so it's interference from a lot of that. Look, it can be done. Nissan on the Nissan Leaf has they have an AM radio on that, so you can do it. But obviously, there's a cost there to do it, and some of them are saying, "Why bother?" And look, Tesla's been one of the ones that just said you can go into the system, the apps on the car, and stream it. Basically, use your go into the streaming services and stream the ones you want. So they're not the only ones doing it, incidentally.
So it doesn't work if you're listening in country Australia to the ABC, though.
That's right. I'm not sure how many Teslas will be bolting out the back of Birdsville to start with. So
yeah, I don't know how many charging stations are out that way.
That's right.
All right, you're not allowed. If you're still listening to us on AM, forget it. All right, let's talk to Garth. Where are you, Garth? Hi, Garth.
Oh, hi. Hi, Suzanne. Hi, Toby.
Hi.
Look, I want to talk about, what the future is going to be like with cars. I've always liked, something that, went pretty hard. I had a succession of V8s.
Yep.
And then about 10 years ago, I bought a German hot hatch.
Yep.
2-litre turbocharged dual clutch gearbox.
Yep.
And I noticed that Mercedes and BMW and some of the Korean brands are also getting into turbocharged motors and twin clutch gearboxes. Mm-hmm. It's a delight to drive because, it's got, its power, almost off idle. What do you think the future is? Is turbocharged, it's efficient. If I drive it on the highway, I get about 7.5 liters per 100 kilometers.
Yep.
I can leave it in auto or I can, use the paddles.
Yeah. So, look, I would say all those things you're talking about there are pretty much that has been the future for the last decade. So that's where we've worked towards to get to now. And if you look at the cars coming out of Europe, there are almost no European vehicles these days that don't have a turbocharger. I think pretty much the only one I could think of the other day, I think you got some Lambos, the V12 and V10 engines in the Lamborghinis, and the Audi R8. And pretty much everything else, actually Ferrari too, Ferrari's got one. But anyway, we're talking tiny volume vehicles. The vast majority of them these days have turbos, and that is where it's been heading. I think what you're going to see, if you're talking about future, what you're going to see over the next 10 or 15 years, the trend, I guess, if we look at the trends going forward, we're still going to see, I think, regular petrol engine vehicles, but they're going to have more electric assistance. So we're going to see what they call mild hybrid systems and also full hybrid systems. Obviously, we're going to see more electric vehicles. We're going to see more of these active safety systems coming in. I think by the end of this decade, the end of the next decade, I should say, because we're not quite there yet. But within the next 10 years, I think we're going to see things like car keys be phased out. And if you look now, things like some BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes are already phasing out car keys. That Tesla Model 3, you don't need a car key. You use your phone, you use an app attached to the phone, and it uses the Bluetooth, the new short-range Bluetooth to start the car and everything. So,
when you lose your phone, you're stuffed, right?
Well, no, because yes, sort of, but they've actually got effectively a credit card. It looks like a credit card, so you can have that in your wallet.
Right.
Although wallets are going out soon, but you can have it somewhere that you can access. But the advantages with things like getting rid of a key, there are many more advantages than disadvantages. So one of them may be, let's say you drive to a friend's house and for whatever reason you end up getting a lift with someone else home, you want someone to drive your car, you'll be able to send them a digital key to their phone and they can then start their car. So yeah, it's got some pretty cool tech with that. I mean, one of the things I'd love to see more car makers do is limit what the cars can do depending on the driver behind the wheel. So, for example, at the moment, we in most states and territories, we ban P-platers from driving high-performance cars. Well, why not just have a system in there that reduces the power, the top speed, whatever it is, to allow them to still drive the car, but in a different mode? I mean, the technology's all there to do it. It's just they don't, at the moment, they don't have the systems to do it.
How about some kind of tech, too, that tells you who's getting in the car and adjusts the seat for you?
That's already here. On Commodore, well, previously on, I think, early 2000s, Commodores had that. So it was linked to the key. So when you unlock the key, when you unlock the car, it would then adjust the seat to that key, and it would then adjust the radio station, everything else. So it would get in the car and do it. And yeah, look, a lot of cars have got that these days where it's, look, Subarus, for example, it's hooked up to facial recognition. So a number of the Subarus, you get in the car, it's got a camera just below the rear vision mirror. It'll read your face, and then it adjusts everything in the car to your face.
Oh, it's already there. All right. Hey, thanks, Garth, for your question, by the way. Now, Toby, we should answer. You had a query a couple of months ago. This was about a car battery going flat when the tailgate of her Subaru was left open at a dog show.
Yeah, that's right. This lady was saying she had, I think it was a Forester, and she'd bought it and left it open at dog shows, and it was flattening the battery, which obviously wasn't working too well for her. But I've been in touch with Subaru a few times about this. They acknowledge it's an issue. They think it's a software issue. So we touched on it a bit and were trying to theorise about some of the things that may have been wrong with it and what was going on. They believe it's a software issue. They are working with Subaru in Japan to do a software update, which they're hoping hoping will solve the issue over the next few months. So stay tuned. Hopefully your car will be not flattening your batteries at dog shows to come.
All right. And perhaps just before we go back to the phones, why don't you tell us what you've been test driving?
I've been driving heaps of stuff in recent weeks, but two of the more interesting ones, and these cars actually share plenty underneath. So the BMW Z4 M40i, which is, it's a little sports car, obviously two-seater sports car convertible. Really sweet engine in this car. It's got a 3-litre six-cylinder turbo, 250 kilowatts of power, terrific drivetrain. So that really makes the car probably a little bit less impressive in other areas. Yes, it does a lot of things right, but it's up against things like a Porsche Boxster. So you expect a car to be pretty special when you're competing with a vehicle like that. But as I said, that engine's the pick of it. And I've also been driving the Toyota Supra, which is exactly the same engine as that car. So it's so these cars underneath, they come out of the same factory. They were developed together. They are identical in terms of their drivetrains and so on. So the engines and all that, the gearboxes are the same. The basic suspension systems are the same, but they look extremely different. So the Toyota's a coupe, not a convertible. It's got very distinctive styling, so a lot of angles and creases and curves and air intakes and so on, which I think in some ways is a little bit busy. But look, as I said, the engine's what defines it. It sort of starts at around $90,000 and goes up to the best part of $100,000. So it's a reasonably expensive Toyota, but when you look at the engine you're getting, it's also fairly good value.
Let's talk to David. You're retiring your older car, David.
Oh, good day, Toby.
Hello.
First of all, I'd like to say that what I know about cars, you can put in a matchbox and still have lots of room left over.
Excellent.
But it's about, it's time to retire my Fairmont AU.
Yeah, wow.
Which I've been very happy with.
Yep.
It's done everything I wanted it to do. It'll tow a 6x4 trailer with blue metal in it and a camper trailer. Now I'm looking at spending about $15,000 on a car that probably 10 years will see me out.
Mm-hmm.
My wife actually kindly suggested the other day that maybe I should look at a car where if I do need a wheelchair in the future, that it would be easy to put a wheelchair in the back.
Yeah, right.
But what should I be looking at? Something.
And what's your price point, David?
15.
Sorry? Oh, 15, yeah.
Yeah, 15 grand. Look, probably the wheelchair is the one that stumps me a little bit because trying to work out all the other factors there that'll work with it and then have the wheelchair go in the back is a challenge because I was starting to think of a lot of passenger cars, so regular sedans that could do the job.
I'm probably looking at a wagon of some sort.
Okay. And you want second hand, yeah?
Yeah,
Yep. Do you like your Fords? You do, obviously.
Look, I'm not fussed, really.
So the only reason...
Something that's going to be reliable, and as I say, see me out for the next 10 years.
Yeah, right. Look, I'll give you a couple of options that will have a wagon option in there, and one of them is a Ford Mondeo.
Yeah.
And the reason I mention that Mondeo is they are a little bit unloved on the used car market, so as a result, you can get a fair bit of value in them. So you can get a relatively new one, say 4 or 5 years old, certainly for that that 15 grand. I think you could probably even get one 3 or 4 years old. And they did a wagon, so there's wagon versions out there. They did obviously petrol engines, diesel engines as well. But if you're not doing big cars, I wouldn't stress too much about the diesel. The other one that I think's worth a bit of a look is something like a Skoda Octavia, which is also a really nice driving car. It's effectively a Volkswagen Golf underneath, but it's got a little bit of a more functional and clever interior. It's got a fair bit of, they did a vast range of engine options, but in particular, the body shapes as well, sedan and hatch, and wagon, sorry, on that. So you can certainly get some good functionality with that. Either of those cars, you're going to be able to get something fairly new for your 15 grand, and you're going to be surprised at some of the features and the performance and so on it's got. They're not going to have that engine that you had in your AU Fairmont, the big 4-litre engine that has so much grunt, but you're going to use probably a little bit less fuel, and you're certainly going to have something a bit more lively on the road. And from a dynamic perspective, handling perspective, something like that Skoda Octavia will do a nicer job for sure. So,
someone has suggested to me a RAV4.
Look, I wouldn't bother with a RAV4 because you're going to have to go fairly old to get something like that for 15 grand. So the RAV4s hold their value very well. And the current generation RAV4 is a great car. It's a really nice car, it's towards the top of its market in terms of the vehicles to get. So if you ask me this question in 5 or 6 years' time, I'd probably say yes. But the previous RAV4 was a little bit underwhelming. So if you want to start looking at those mid-sized SUVs, what would I get in there? I'd probably look at something like a Mazda CX-5. You can get plenty in that, and you'll end up with a nicer car than the RAV4. Subaru Forester would also be worth a look, some of the older Subaru Foresters. So those two would be on my list ahead of a RAV4.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, David. Good luck in your search. Now, I have to read this SMS from Steve, the Fat Patroller. So I've got an 01 dual cab diesel Hilux. I've done 508,000 Ks. Still runs like a dream. It's idled on the side of the road for 12 hours a day for years. Services? Never bothered. I changed glow plugs for the first time since new at 464,000 Ks. He says, we call it Christopher's case because it never stops running. And I thought that was actually a nice segue into the story about the former boss of Nissan, Carlos Ghosn. Tell us about his rather daring escape from house arrest in Japan.
Look, this is phenomenal. This has only come out in the news in the last couple of days. Hollywood could not have come up with a story as good as this, and I'm sure someone will make a movie out of it or a series or something, because it is just incredible. But yeah, look, he was under house arrest in Japan. He was actually in jail for quite a while. He then posted a $20 million bond so that he could go and live still in Japan, and but in a house, obviously, rather than jail. But he was being shadowed pretty heavily by a private detective, by police. He had surveillance on his house. He wasn't allowed to use internet or email or anything like that.
What had he done?
He'd been accused of taking secret payments and underreporting his income, so basically tax fraud.
Yeah.
And so he was facing a long time in jail. And anyway, he has actually managed to get away and be the world's most famous fugitive. So
Now, how did he do it?
Well, this is the incredible thing. He apparently, and look, he said he's going to talk to media in a week and go through the full details of it, but he apparently organised for Christmas a Gregorian band to come and play a concert at his house. And that band left and packed up all their instruments, and apparently he stuffed himself into one of the double bass cases of the band and managed to get out. And they had a charter flight at the airport and somehow got him on the flight. Now, again, all these details have got to be confirmed, and there's got to be, I guess, work out exactly how it was done. I dare say he probably won't go into massive details, but managed to somehow get back to Lebanon, which is where he grew up. He was born in Brazil but grew up in Lebanon, and he's back there, and apparently...
And he's at liberty, is he?
At liberty, yeah. So he's a bit of a... Well, he was a hero in Japan too. He actually had a comic book made about him in Japan, a comic book series made about him. He was a hero previously in Japan. And in where he grew up in Lebanon, he was absolutely extremely highly regarded and a bit of a hero there as well. So they were very much behind him. So
So he's not about to be extradited back to Japan.
Well, apparently there's no extradition treaty between Lebanon and Japan, and indeed Japan and a lot of countries. I think the USA and Korea is where I read are the only two places they have an extradition treaty with. So here we. It looks like he'll be free, but
all the glorious details of his escape in a music case.
He's been reported as saying that there were injustices and all sorts of stuff. So, but look, as I said, incredible story I don't think anyone in Hollywood would have come up with something that good. So,
absolutely,
it's terrific. Can't wait to hear more about it.
And now a quick one from Lou on the SMS. What do you think about the 2019 Subaru Outback Premium?
I think the Outback generally is a nice car. It's getting towards the end of its life. So it's been out a little while now. In the Subaru range, to me, the Forester is a more impressive car. It's not quite as luxurious as the Outback, but the Forester is a bit more of an impressive car. But that said, the Outback is a terrific car for what it is in terms of it gives you some of that off-road flavour, and it's actually surprisingly competent off-road. They've really thought about the design of that car. So if you do want to do some gravel tracks and so on, it'll do them pretty comfortably. Heaps of gear in it, heaps of safety gear in it, very functional and spacious interior, and it's a reasonable thing. The engine's not super impressive, but it gets the job done, and in terms of value for money, it's a reasonable car. And the one thing I do like about it is it's giving you some of that SUV flavour, but more as more of a crossover, so more of a regular wagon with a little bit of ride height. So it drives better than a lot of those mid-sized SUVs, and it's terrific value as well.
All right, thanks, Lou. Gillian.
Hello, Toby.
Hello.
Yeah, hello, Toby. How are you?
Very well.
Listen, I'm thinking about buying a dual cab. Well, I've got to buy a ute. I need a ute. So I'm looking at a dual cab, Nissan Navara, and I've come up with a couple. I haven't got a lot of money, so I'm looking at secondhand. Mm-hmm. And I found a diesel. It's a 2006 with about 130,000 on the clock, so a turbo diesel. It's well over 10 grand. And then I've also, in pretty good condition too. And then I found another one, and it's only got 100, it's a 2000 model, and it's only got 118,000 on the clock, but it's a V6 petrol. Well under 10 grand.
Yeah. So the challenge with either of these cars, so the cars you're looking at are 15 to 20 years old, and it is going to come down completely to the condition of the vehicle, how well it's been looked after, how well it's the service books, all that sort of stuff. So it's very hard to sit here and say, you know, definitely go for that one over the other one.
The diesel's had a couple of owners, and it's in fair condition.
Yep.
The petrol, one owner, and it's near immaculate.
Yeah,
and all of its services, everything right up to date.
Yeah, okay. Well, the petrol sounds like it's a better bet in that regard, but you're looking at a 5 year, 6 year older vehicle. So, the challenge as when I'm talking about condition, I wouldn't be worried that much about exterior condition. I'd be more concerned about what's under the bonnet and if something's going to go bang. I mean, you know, a lot of cars will comfortably go 20, 30, 40 years without a problem, but they're starting to get to the point where things and expensive things can go wrong with them. You know, these days, obviously, the dual cab market is very heavily skewed towards diesel engines. So that's, I guess, the favoured fuel these days. But it used to be the other way around. It used to be petrol engines. And that's why you're getting that V6 petrol one there of the early 2000s. So, but as I said, it'd be coming purely down to condition. I'd be going in eyes wide open and also expecting that something might need to be done or might go wrong with it because you're looking at older vehicles that potentially have done a lot of work in their life.
It's like the mileage. I'm sort of looking at the mileage more than the age. The diesel's only got 130,000 on the clock, which isn't a lot for a diesel, I gather.
No.
And the petrol has only got 118,000 genuine kilometres on it.
Yeah, that's right. But if it's, you know, if it's 118,000 k's of towing a 3.5-tonne horse float or something, then it's going to work the engine pretty hard. And funnily enough, also a car that hasn't been driven much, some of those cars actually doing big country kilometres. So if you've got one with 200,000 or 300,000 k's and they're just sitting at 80 or 100 k's an hour on a country road, that can be pretty gentle on a car. Whereas if it's been a courier vehicle around town and it's been thrashed at, you know, 0 to 60 k's an hour all day, every day, that's when you start to get a lot of wear as well. So again, I'd be eyes wide open on both of them.
Thanks, Gillian. Let's see if we can squeeze in one or two more before we get to the news. Actually, let me just mention, Toby, the New South Wales government's going to be providing labels for number plates of hybrid and electric cars. Why is that?
So, well, this is mainly for emergency services. So so they've been doing this in Victoria for quite a while now. So it's on the number plates. It'll have either an EV or hybrid sticker on the number plate so that if you're involved in a crash or if the car's on fire, whatever it is, and the fire department or rolls up to try and sort things out, they then are trained in how to deal with electric vehicles and what cords to unplug and what potential issues they might come across with a battery, a big battery pack potentially going up in flames. So it's predominantly for emergency services. The thing that really does my head in with this is how they've done it. So they've chosen to do different labels to the one used in Victoria, which this happens so often in cars, where you end up with different regulations and different systems around the country, rather than just saying, hey, that's a good idea. Can we just borrow your stickers and stick them on our one?
Yeah, so we've all got the same. Yeah.
Instead, they've obviously had committees and meetings, and then someone's had to go and design them and do all this sort of stuff, all with our taxpayer money. And I'm sure we'll end up with six other stickers from other states and territories as well. So.
Oh, dear. All right, Matt, let's see if we can get an answer for you. You're looking at some car advice?
Yeah.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm looking at a couple of utes. Two of the VF Series 2 SS utes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got two separate questions here. The VF Series 1 utes, do they have the same, basically all the same as what the VF 2 has, in the way of the exhaust and all that sort of stuff, or...
Look, you're testing me there. Obviously, the basic mechanicals, yes, are the same. So in terms of engines and the platform, the body generally is all the same. Series 3 was where they got a little bit different in terms of engines and so on. But between the Series 1 and 2, I believe so. But Holden used to do updates pretty much every year or two for all these cars. And things they used to tweak, things like power outputs. And sometimes that would involve exhaust systems. So... the answer is I don't know 100%.
All right, Matt, what's the second question? Because we are starting to run out of time.
Okay, second one is I'm also looking at the E Series 3 Malu Ute and Gen F Ute.
Mm-hmm.
They both have what they call driving selection mode.
Mm-hmm.
What is that exactly?
So, driving selection mode, are you talking with suspension and so on, or?
I don't know whether it's located in the E3, but in the Gen S, it's like a little dial on the... near the gear.
Oh, right, yeah. So that's
right,
just
so
things
you've
like,
got 50 seconds.
Yeah, that's things like throttle response. So it also incorporated exhaust sound, although from memory, I think the balloons missed out on the exhaust flap so that it changed the exhaust. But effectively, it's throttle response and so on. I wouldn't be too fussed with that. Yes, the Maloo was a great thing. You're obviously going to pay more for one of the same era, but I would absolutely be happy with an SS Commodore Ute. They were terrific value for money, and the VFs were great. So for my money, it'd be heading a little bit towards the VF. And you're certainly going to have more options with the VF in terms of vehicles available on the second-hand market. So that'd be it.
All right, Matt. Thank you, Toby. It's so wonderful to be able to welcome you back to Nightlife for another year. Thanks for being here.
Love it.
Toby Hagen, of course, he'll be back in a fortnight's time. If you missed out tonight, make sure you're hot on those phones in 2 weeks' time to talk to Toby.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.